everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's August 2023, and you're listening to episode 352, which is a spoiler-filled conversation about the film Oppenheimer, which is in theaters now. On this episode, I'm joined by Cole Burgett, who's a graduate of Dallas Theological Seminary and the Moody Bible Institute. He teaches classes in Bible exposition and systematic theology. He also writes extensively about theology and popular culture. Cole has written a film review of Oppenheimer, and his review is called Fire from the Gods: How Oppenheimer Mythologizes 20th Century America, and you can read his review for free at our website, equip.org. Cole, it's good to have you on the podcast again.
It's always good to be here. Thank you.
Today, as I mentioned, we're talking about the film Oppenheimer, which has been a box office success so far, and it was highly anticipated, one of the most highly anticipated releases of this summer. And so far worldwide, it's made more than $400 million and almost $200 million domestically in the United States. Now, Christopher Nolan is the director of Oppenheimer, and he is well known for a certain type of film and probably best known for his Batman Begins series of films, but also for Inception and Tenet. So for some of our listeners who might not be familiar with the breadth of Christopher Nolan's work, who is he and where does this particular film, Oppenheimer, fit into the catalog of his work? And then also, how does Nolan in general approach storytelling? Because I think that will be helpful as we start talking about this film.
Sure. So Christopher Nolan is a very, very popular director these days. Could probably be argued that he is of the cultural moment and of the sort of the 2010s era, probably the most important, significant director working because of his body of work, because of what he does in his body of work and the way he tells his stories and that sort of thing. Christopher Nolan really became prominent when he worked on what is now called the Dark Knight trilogy, where Batman Begins, The Dark Knight, The Dark Knight Rises, back in the mid-aughts, as we'll call them, the mid to late aughts. And I think The Dark Knight came out The Dark Knight Rises, I think, came out in 2012. The Dark Knight came out in 2008, something like that. But those are the films that really put Nolan on the mainstream map and, you know, made him a certifiable sort of smash hit director. He would later go on to do such films as Inception and Interstellar, both hugely popular films, especially Inception. And then he would do Tenet as well, Dunkirk, another very popular film that he did, and then Oppenheimer. And it's sort of really easy to pick out a Christopher Nolan film if you know his style of filmmaking, and you're shown, you know, 5 minutes of a clip, a 5 minute clip of a film, and you're not told who directed it, you can pretty much pick it out as Christopher Nolan's. His films tend to be very philosophical. They tend to play with time in ways that are very vaguely defined, so that the audience has to sort of race to keep up. You have to really pay attention to figure out, you know, when the camera is cutting between different time frames and things like this. And this applies to Oppenheimer as well. As far as his style, he's a great fan of IMAX, shooting in IMAX. So a lot of the IMAX cameras and use of IMAX cameras are popular. His name is almost synonymous with IMAX and that type of filmmaking. If anybody cares about that sort of thing, you know that Nolan's sort of the poster child for the IMAX camera and that sort of stuff. But there's always like a constant undercurrent of music through his films. It's constantly playing under the scenes, and it's very like nerve grating music that keeps the audience engaged, keeps you on edge. keeps your brain sort of fraying at the seams. And his films are usually very philosophical in the stories he likes to tell. There are always these lofty themes that he likes to sort of deal with. And he's very unafraid of probing science and the ideas that science is interested in, but in a way that is very scientific and accurate. Interstellar is a good example of that. The idea of string theory is very prominent in Interstellar. In Oppenheimer, major discussions of quantum mechanics and detailed discussions of quantum mechanics, and not necessarily done in a way that people who don't know what quantum mechanics is will be able to understand it. But that's done very intentionally by Nolan. His approach is less, let me break this down for the audience, and more, let me be accurate to the material that I'm dealing with. And so watching a Christopher Nolan film is sort of like an experience, right? This is what he's sort of known as now. You go to a Christopher Nolan movie, you know you're in for a showstopper, a very complex, detailed, morally complicated, philosophical piece that may have action, it may have not. What sets Oppenheimer now apart from that bunch is that Oppenheimer you can classify it as a certifiable epic. I mean, I think Interstellar could probably be classified as that as well. An epic in the old Hollywood sense of the word, like a Dr. Zhivago or something like that. But it is also a biographical film. It's a biographical film that's really sort of a loose adaptation of a book, which we can talk about later. But it's very different in terms of what Nolan has done before. It's a very different type of film. But I also think it's probably his best film. I think it's his most pretentious also in some ways. But it's certainly, I think, that the best film he's done.
It seems to me that Nolan has certain kinds of films. They're not all similar, but some of his well-known works that are favorites, going all the way back to what he kind of burst on the scene with in terms of awareness, which was Memento.
Memento. Yeah. Yes. And I'll just put this out there. My favorite Christopher Nolan film is a little film from 2002 called Insomnia with Al Pacino and Robin Williams.
That was a good film.
Yeah, that's my favorite film he's done. Anyway, sorry, continue.
I was going to say, I saw a list of good and bad films, and I think, or, you know, ranking of Nolan's. I think they put that film as his worst one. But I find that some of the way he tells his stories is, and maybe because he looks at time, is he tries not to be linear, and sometimes he does it in a disorienting way. So I think that was new for Memento. I think it took a while for audiences to realize, oh, this is not a linear story told in the way we normally see a movie. It's something different.
Yeah, and you see that way of doing the stories sort of goes throughout his work. It reached its zenith in Tenet, which was just a mind-warping time travel film, but which I was kind of disappointed in because I'm a huge time travel nerd. I think it's extremely hard to tell a time travel story well. I almost sort of think it's like the holy grail of like sci-fi. If you can tell a good time travel story that is scientifically accurate, and because of that, Tenet was kind of boring. I thought because I all the twists were very obvious to me, which I guess it's just knowing the genre. But Inception is another good example of the way that he plays with time, where every time you go deeper in a dream, time works differently in each level, including reality. So he's always working this into his movies in some way, shape, form, or fashion. But like you said, if you don't know Nolan's body of work, if you don't know that's something he's doing, it can be extremely jarring. Was it Dunkirk that there were three timelines that the movie followed, but like never did the movie tell you, okay, now you're in this timeline. It would just cut and you had to like piece together, this is happening before this and this is happening after this.
I'm not sure, but I want to ask you about the actual subject matter of the film Oppenheimer, because it's interesting to me, Christopher Nolan, of all of his films, he's done a lot of sci-fi and nerd type films with Batman and so forth, but the two films that he's done that are in the historical drama kind of category are both taking place in World War II. Dunkirk, which you just mentioned, which was a 2017 film he did. And then this one, Oppenheimer, I think it brings back, especially for younger audiences, they may have no idea what the context of this film is about. So what is it?
Yeah, so Oppenheimer, just being a biographical film, is sort of a dramatization of the life of J. Robert Oppenheimer, the guy who's considered the father of the atomic bomb. The film primarily pulls from a book called American Prometheus, but it sort of has chosen to kind of mythologize the 20th century setting in which the story unfolds, with this character of Robert Oppenheimer at the center of the narrative. And I think the film is Nolan's way of exploring different political ideas that were prominent in the 20th century, and the way that they sort of are the echo of those are still heard or felt today. But the film is really just it's a biographical film, and it's always sort of tough to give a summary of a biographical film, because it's just the life of a person from the time Oppenheimer is a young man, first getting into quantum physics, first getting into his field of study, up through the real core meat of the movie is the development of the first atomic bomb, the first of the nuclear weapons, how that comes about, and then seeing the toll that really just a prodigious intellect, the toll that his genius takes on him. And then, of course, you know, sort of his legacy is overshadowed by the Red Scare in America, where Nolan very clearly positions Oppenheimer as sort of a victim of that through the security hearings and Oppenheimer's early affiliations with the Communist Party, things like that. So the film, again, it's really tough to just say, well here's what the film is about. It's the life of J. Robert Oppenheimer, and that's why the film is called what it is. But the real crux of the film is the development of the first nuclear weapon.
I think some of our listeners and subscribers missed our big announcement back in June that the Christian Research Journal is ceasing its print edition of the magazine that we've had for more than 45 years. And now we're going from your mailbox to your favorite digital device and your email inbox and going all digital, but no subscription is required anymore. All of our articles and content from the Christian Research Journal, which becomes a digital magazine, is available to everyone worldwide for free. But you might not want to miss out on our very last collector's edition double issue that's a special theme, and it's going to be the last print issue of the journal. So if you would like to receive that, maybe you've never subscribed before. Now, if you're a subscriber, you're going to receive this issue. If you've never subscribed to our print edition before, you won't want to miss this, because this, as I said, is going to be a special collector's edition. Now, how do you get this issue? You go on over to equip.org, you click on journal, then you will go and you are going to click on support, and then you will hit the landing page to get a copy with your partnering donation for the Christian Research Journal. So we hope that you will get this special issue. It's the very last one that will ever be in print after many decades of being a print magazine, and we are not going anywhere. We are going to continue to be the Christian Research Journal, available to you. All of your favorite kinds of articles will still continue, but now in an exclusively digital format on our website and not under a paywall. Now, a lot of magazines and newspapers have gone to an all-digital format, but they have a paywall. You won't find that with the Christian Research Journal, so please do share our content widely. Let people know about your favorite articles, your favorite interviews with your authors on the Postmodern Realities podcast. Please keep telling people about the podcast. And again, if you've been subscribing faithfully for many years, thank you so much. We appreciate your support and continue on getting all of our content, but now for free, not under a paywall. And now back to our conversation about the film Oppenheimer, directed by Christopher Nolan, with our guest today, Cole Burgett. You just mentioned briefly that this film is based on a book called American Prometheus, which is a biography that of him that was published in 2005. In fact, it's more than 700 pages, and it went on to win the Pulitzer Prize. And the actual title of the book is called American Prometheus, The Triumph and Tragedy of J. Robert Oppenheimer. And actually, it took the authors about 25 years to write this book. So it's not a very easy subject, I guess, to cover in a very engaging way. And so actually, the myth of Prometheus is mentioned in the film. So can you tell us a little bit about Prometheus and why the character in the film of Oppenheimer is framed in this way? And I guess any of our readers who want to tackle a 700 plus page biography and get into all the details can put that on their reading list.
So the myth of Prometheus is probably the most well-known classical tragedy in the pop culture lexicon today, and it has been kept alive through different works. Ridley Scott did the film Prometheus, where the myth of Prometheus is talked about. The big one, I think, that everyone is familiar with, whether they know it or not, is Frankenstein by Mary Shelley, the 1818 novel, which carried the subtitle The Modern Prometheus. One of the, if not the best episodes of The X-Files in the 90s was called The Postmodern Prometheus, nominated for a bunch of awards, winning a bunch of awards, always talked about. So the idea of Prometheus has been kept in the public conscience for a very long time, especially due to modernity. And the way that Nolan has done the film, adapting it from this book, is very apt, because he positions Oppenheimer, and this is what I meant by mythologizing the 20th century, he positions Oppenheimer as an American version of Prometheus, as a mythic character, and really leans into that more than anything else. Well, what does that mean? Well, in the myth of Prometheus, Prometheus was this, he defied the gods, essentially. He defied the Olympian gods of Greek mythology in order to steal the secret of fire from them and bring it to humanity. And fire, as we know, is, you know, many people call a primal element. It's important for technology. It's important for survival. It's important for civilization as a whole. And so Prometheus steals fire from the Olympian gods and he gives it to humanity. And it sort of kicks off the growing civilization. As a result of this, Prometheus is punished for a very, very long time. There are several tragedies, classic tragedies, that are considered lost works. Prometheus Bound is one of them. I think the sequence is supposed to be Prometheus Bound, Prometheus Unbound, and then Prometheus the Firebringer, which sort of chronicle this narrative. And again, those are considered lost or incomplete. I think you can find versions of Prometheus Bound, but I think that's the only complete text that is preserved. I could be very wrong about that, but I know there is a sequence there. But anyway, Prometheus becomes this sort of metaphor, if you will, for anything related to forbidden knowledge. In literary circles, there is frequent discussions about a particular theme or idea or trope, if you will, regarding this idea of forbidden knowledge. It's a common device in mythic storytelling. And I'll, you know, this is why when you know, someone says, asks me, well, is Genesis mythic? I say, well, yeah. They think, what, so you mean it, you don't believe in a literal creation? No, that's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying it's mythic. I'm not saying it's not true. We have a very, very different definitions of what mythic means. For example, the idea of forbidden knowledge, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. There is something they ought not have known. There is something that the man and the woman ought not have discovered. There is something that they ought not have chosen for themselves, being autonomy. And as a result, they pay for that. This is a theme that runs throughout classic literature. The best class I have ever taken and ended up teaching for, I ended up working for the teacher who taught it and have taught units of this course, is called Forbidden Knowledge in the Monstrous Novel. And I sat through it at a Christian institution. It was sort of life-changing in a lot of ways. And the class was essentially an exploration of evil through classic monster novels, really using as a basis this theme of forbidden knowledge. One thesis I've worked on for a while is that there's a reason we no longer tell monster stories, at least not in the same vein as Frankenstein or Dracula, these sort of gothic monster stories. And that's because we really do live in Mary Shelley's nightmare. In the modern era, Mary Shelley had the foresight to see that with the advent of science and the Enlightenment and modernity, the onset of modernity in 1818, that science would get to a point of playing God and saying, you know, this might not work out for you. If you know anything about the novel Frankenstein, not, you know, the distilled where we are now in the culture, kind of thinking of Boris Karloff with the you know, the nubs on his neck, that kind of thing. But in the original novel, you know, Frankenstein, the creator, is really seeking to triumph science over God and create life, and it becomes his undoing. And the sort of the point of the book is, you know, just let sleeping dogs lie. There are certain things you probably shouldn't try to tap into because you're not God. Oppenheimer very much plays in that same realm. Again, the subtitle of Frankenstein is the modern Prometheus. Oppenheimer's is just the American Prometheus. It's the same idea. If Frankenstein gave life, then Oppenheimer is the herald of the end of the world because of the advent of nuclear weapons. So the way the film portrays the man is far more as a kind of mythic character, and 20th century America as far more of a mythic landscape than it is history. That's not to say it's not historically accurate. It's just to say that the angle that the storyteller, being Nolan, the angle that Nolan takes into the story is that of myth. And that's really interesting. It's really fascinating. And it creates a myriad opportunities for a Christian apologist to come along and really be able to interact with this material because it's mythic, because it's timeless, because it's apocalyptic. There's certainly room for a Christian apologist to come in and bring a really interesting angle to this conversation.
This is interesting. Yesterday, I was at the grocery store and they are trying to do little chit chat. So the kid that was working there, probably a college student, asked me what I did for a living. And I mentioned what I do in the podcast, but I also mentioned that we cover pop culture things and said we were going to do something on Oppenheimer. And he literally said, as someone who I think was not a religious person, well, why in the world would a Christian even watch a movie like that? I mean, why would you care about it? He actually said that to me as someone who is a non-Christian.
That is interesting.
It was very interesting. I mean, there are people in line after me, so I didn't have time to say, but I did say because there are themes that are in popular culture, television shows, series, and movies that I think cover issues that we could, as someone who's religious, talk to someone who's not religious about. And we kind of ended there. But he specifically asked me that question. So I think a lot of Christians would think, well, why are you watching these movies? And yet here was a Gen Z person asking me, well, why in the world would you watch this? So why should Christians care about this particular version of the story? And first of all, I think a lot of people watching it want to know, well, is this historically accurate? I mean, when I saw Dunkirk, I didn't know very much. I'm not a World War II buff. And so I had a hard time understanding what was going on, what was the significance of it. And so how should people approach if they don't really know, especially the younger generation? I mean, they aren't that familiar with World War II. I mean, they know some big things about it, like the concentration camps and Hitler and so forth. But they, some of these other things, they just don't have that much information. So they want to know, well, is what I'm watching true? Did that happen?
You know, just to riff on this for just a second. When Interstellar came out, which is another Christopher Nolan film, and there is a point to what I'm saying here. When Interstellar came out, after it came out on DVD, my father, who's sort of still there in the backwoods of West Virginia, where I grew up, they had gotten a Blu-ray player, and they were very excited about this. I know. But I got them Interstellar. And it was sort of an experiment on my part, because I know that they're never going to be able to watch this film, because they just don't. It's just not how their minds work. And so they started watching it, and they got about 20 minutes into it, and they were like, we don't get it. Like, this is dumb to us. Like, this is such a dumb film. And I'm thinking, you know, it's so funny to me that here are these very committed fundamentalist Christians. And again, I consider myself a happy fundamentalist. But here are these very committed fundamentalist Christians who are watching what pretty much anybody would consider to be perhaps the most one of the more intelligent, you know, blockbusters ever made. And they're like, this is dumb. And I always thought, man, if you can't sell it to these people, who can you sell it to? But so it's given me a lot of thought about Nolan's stuff over time, and if it's even worth, you know, bothering with. But at the end of the day, I do think watching a Christopher Nolan film as a Christian is a safe bet, because there is a lot of interesting philosophy in there. But they're also fairly clean films. One of the you mentioned earlier, what sets Oppenheimer apart? Well, for one thing, it's the dirtiest film, I think, that Nolan has made.
There was a lot of debate, like, this is going to be an R-rated film.
Yeah.
So I kind of knew going in there was, you know, it said.
Yeah, there's some skin in this one. That's sort of, you know, uncharacteristic of Nolan as a filmmaker. But considering the subject matter and the seriousness of this stuff, I mean, it's sort of done in a way that, you know, it's understandable, I think. But this is absolutely not a film for children. Anyway, as far as the historical accuracy, it's not historically inaccurate. I'll say it that way. But I think it would sort of be a mistake to suggest that this is a film that prioritizes historical accuracy over the mythic storytelling, because I don't think it is. I think Nolan's interest here is in painting a particular portrait of the man as a very conflicted character. I think if you, for example, this is a very self-serious movie, which is like a trademark of Christopher Nolan, and the characters are very self-serious. Something tells me that all of these characters that we see in this film were not as self-serious in actuality. So if the solution is, the idea is to say, well, it's a historically accurate film, I don't think that's what Nolan prioritizes, but I don't think he intentionally goes out of his way to be historically inaccurate. I just think trying to go to this and watching it as a kind of documentary is very much the wrong approach, and will leave the viewer sort of kind of questioning, what on earth is, what's the point? I don't get it. It's he does weird things with music, and it's just odd. And there are all of these, you know, very strange moments where it's like the camera will just cut, and it's almost like a jump scare, where you're sort of being taken inside of Oppenheimer's mind, and he's putting things together and seeing the potential of the end of the world and what an explosion looks like. And it's very, very jarring. Anyway, why should Christians care about Christopher Nolan's version of this story or this particular angle? Again, because it is very mythic. Nolan is one of the few mainstream directors working today who really invites discussion. I think he makes these films in a way that someone like a Christian can approach the material with complex questions, not basic questions like, what is quantum physics? Even though that's a very valid question to ask after watching this film, and it's one I think Christians should ask. I mean, how many times have I said on this podcast, I think, you know, Christians neglect quantum physics to their detriment. And this film really gets into that. But complex questions about the end of the world. I mean, this is Nolan's apocalypse. Eschatology is a question that, you know, Christians should talk more about eschatology after watching Oppenheimer. This film puts a very serious apocalyptic vision, and not just a vision, but a potentiality, a possibility in front of audience members. And it doesn't really end on, let's say, a happy note. I mean, Nolan's other films have sort of ended very hopefully. This film, you know, literally ends with Robert Oppenheimer entertaining the possibility that he has destroyed the world. You know, it's CGI, obviously, but I mean, it's literally the Earth going up in a fireball at the end of the movie because of these nuclear weapons. And that's also what I mean when I say this is a very lofty film and sort of pretentious in some ways. But the idea is the Christian can absolutely find inroads into talking with other people about this film. And the fact that the film is successful shows you two things. One, it shows you that there actually is a mainstream director in Hollywood who sort of has an auteur style, to even use that word, who really is interested in these ideas of eschatology and things like that. But also that there's an appetite for it. People like these kinds of stories. We have been, it's a very weird film. We have been in a post-apocalyptic phase for a while, right? Christians are obsessed with the apocalypse, or they should be anyway, in some ways. So are mainstream, you know, audience goers, whether they're Christian or not. People love these end of the world scenarios. And this film is not a post-apocalyptic film, but it's almost like a beginning of the apocalypse, the beginning of a possible apocalypse film. And it's really interesting that it's done that way. And it presents, you know, a myriad inroads to discussing these kinds of topics. And I think it's something, you know, certainly a film Christians can, if not get behind, pay attention to and have discussions about.
Now, the film seems to present Oppenheimer as kind of a conflicted person, especially at the end of his career, you know, in terms of having certain clearance. And he also founded Los Alamos. I didn't know that. That was interesting to see that. I don't know if everything they said about Los Alamos and his involvement was true, because you said it wasn't, you know, they're not trying to technically be historically accurate. But it's interesting. How do you see Nolan portraying Oppenheimer? Because some people have walked away from the film thinking, especially because it takes place in the 1950s McCarthy era, that now this version of Oppenheimer, after he has helped to create the nuclear bomb and the use of it for the military, now he is somebody who is maybe regretting that. And so he becomes more of a pacifist, or kind of promoting that worldview. Do you think that is how Nolan portrayed him? Because specifically, now one of the co-authors is now deceased, but one of the other co-authors for the book that we were talking about, the biography on Oppenheimer, they do have very strong political views and would say that that is exactly who Oppenheimer was.
Yeah, I absolutely think that Nolan intends to portray Oppenheimer as this this very conflicted, even paradoxical figure. And I think that's sort of the draw of portraying him as a tragic figure, a tragic mythological figure. And what's interesting is all throughout the film, you sort of have these characters as he goes along that are sort of warning him, you know, like, are you really thinking about where this road ends? Like what you're giving people the power to do. This is that scene that's been heavily promoted in the trailers where, Matt Damon's character asks him, you know, what, when this happens, you know, when you set off a nuclear device, you know, is it, are you going to ignite the atmosphere? Essentially, are you going to ignite the particles and start a chain reaction that just incinerates the world? What is the probability of this happening? The chances of this happening? And, you know, Oppenheimer, played by Cillian Murphy, his response is, well, it's near zero. And Matt Damon's character is like, that's not good enough. it needs to be zero. And so there's this through line through the film of him very much sort of grappling with this. And then, of course, we know that the device is successful. It doesn't blow up the world. But what he has now done is given people nuclear capabilities. And he's him sort of living to regret that. Just as Prometheus stole this sort of secret knowledge from the gods and brought it to humanity, living to regret it, living the rest of his life to regret it. That's very much how Oppenheimer is portrayed here, as someone who sort of lives the rest of his life, in a sense, regretting what he's done. There's that wonderful, wonderful scene between him and Emily Blunt, who plays his wife in this film, where afterwards he's very distraught at what he has created and sort of recedes him to himself and sort of takes it out on his family in a sense. And she has that great moment with him where she confronts him and she says, you don't get to do this. You don't get to be selfish all the time. You don't get to be the guy who has to be the man to build this device and then get to turn around and be the guy who carries the weight of the world on his shoulders because of what he's done. That's not fair to the world, and it's not going to happen with us. It's a great, great scene. You wonder if it's apocryphal. Did she ever actually say that to the man? Who knows? But in the movie, it's a great, layered, complex, very, very good scene. Well acted, and the dialogue is so sharp there. But all that to say, Oppenheimer is portrayed as somewhat paradoxical, very conflicted, and it's very interesting to me that Nolan almost portrays the character as someone who is cursed with intellect. And, you know, I've met, here's how I'll say this. I have met maybe 2 to 3 people in my life in various capacities that are certifiable geniuses. IQ off the charts, just you talk to them, you listen to them talk, and you come away from that discussion. They say this individual actually sees the world through a very, you know, skewed set of eyes in the best way possible, certifiable genius. At the same time, you walk away from those conversations going, my goodness, this person could never function in just normal society. It just couldn't do it. Really through no fault of their own. It's just the way that their brain works. Oppenheimer is very much that, as Nolan portrays him. Someone who is too smart for his own good, to say it that way. And alongside that, what walks alongside him is the sense of pride, this sense of intellectual hubris. And you see that. This is a guy who, as Nolan portrays him, absolutely understands the possibility of what he could unleash in building this device, but he just can't not build the device. He absolutely has to do it, and he has to be the one to do it. He has to be the one to head the project. It has to be him. Even though he's sitting there, you know, telling Matt Damon's character, you know, there's a good chance that we just, you know, we blow up the world. We do this. And there's a real hubris there. And that's part of the richness of the literary elements of the film. That's part of the richness of the tragic dimensions of Oppenheimer's character, because it gets into what in literary conversations we would call the fatal flaw, or the hamartia, which comes from the Greek word for sin. This sort of constant flaw that follows a character through their life, through their development, that ultimately becomes their own doing. Oedipus Rex is a great example of that. Oedipus's confidence in his ability to reason he misses the most fundamental and sort of obvious things that ultimately lead him to the worst discovery that he's missed of his entire life. And yet he's so confident in his intelligence that it's not an issue. A more popular example that may, you know, sort of help listeners see this is the character of Anakin Skywalker in the prequels. He has this kind of hubris. He has this kind of pride, this anger that he's right. He's always right. He sees it for how it truly is and everybody else is wrong. And it's that particular facet of his personality that Palpatine manipulates across the first three films that ultimately leads to Anakin sort of willingly becoming Vader without even realizing that he's walked himself into this because of his hubris. Achilles is another great example. Achilles has a heel, but Achilles also has great hubris, and it's actually his hubris that becomes his undoing. Oppenheimer stands in that tradition of storytelling, and at least in Nolan's hands, the character of Robert Oppenheimer stands in that tradition of tragic heroes. He is Victor Frankenstein, just in 20th century America, not Mary Shelley's 1818 version of the world in that story. He is Prometheus. He is an American version of Prometheus and not a, ancient Greek Titan. And it creates this rich conflict and paradox at the heart of the character that, you know, is sort of honest about how people are. People often have very conflicting motivations. I think if postmodernity, to even call it that, it's what we're going to call it, whatever. If there's one thing postmodernity has sort of shown us, it's that no one is unbiased. And those biases, or biases rather, all can stem from a plethora of emotions and stimuli. No one is sort of consistent and steady, but the human experience, it can be paradoxical even. It's the same thing that Brennan Manning, the late Brennan Manning, is one of my favorite writers, who was a very, very committed Catholic until the moments he started to sound like not a Catholic, which I thought was very interesting. He has a wonderful line in the Ragamuffin Gospel, which is one of my favorite books, where he talks about himself being a paradox, being an angel with an incredible capacity for beer. Again, the paradox of the human experience, the conflicting emotions, the knowing you're doing the wrong thing, but you're going to do it because you just really, really want it. It's paradoxical. And Nolan presents Oppenheimer in that way, which in a way humanizes him more than anything else, just by making him a mythic figure.
So as I was talking about earlier, there is this post-dropping of the bomb part of the film that is very political. And one thing people should know about this film is, I don't know that we've mentioned, it's 3 hours long and much of it is quite dialogue heavy. So there's a lot of different scenes of, you know, different congressional trials and so forth, both public and private.
This is the talkiest film I think I have ever seen.
I don't know if it's well, there's some pretty talky Aaron Sorkin films, but this one is very talky.
This one's up there. It's a lot of hushed tones and speaking urgently with music in the background.
It is interesting to see a lot of, you know, how they can make classroom scenes at UC Berkeley exciting, because they're basically, you know, talking about physics classes and so forth. But anyway, there is this political element to it. And, you know, they are covering this portion of Oppenheimer's, the latter part of his life, where he loses his security clearance, as I alluded to earlier, due to some like backroom trials that he was in. But do you think that Christopher Nolan is making a political statement? Because I was saying earlier, it seems like the book itself, from which it was based, was trying to make a political statement, or maybe it wasn't. I haven't read the book, but at least the authors have been making, or the one living author has been making political statements about the film and Oppenheimer since its release. So does Nolan himself try to be particularly political, especially because of the time in which it was going on at that time after the war, especially in America, there was this big kind of fear of communism. And I'm not saying communism is a good thing, but there was that undercurrent. And Oppenheimer himself had been associated with communists and had, while he was not a member, the movie says he's not a member of the Communist Party, he was involved in that political scene in California.
Yeah, so this is worth talking about. Very early on in his life, Oppenheimer, when he was first, I think he was probably late 20s, early 30s around this time, he just was sort of affiliated, is how the film is going to suggest it, through connections, not necessarily because of his own politics, but just connected to the American Communist Party. I think his brother was a member, and among some other people. And through those connections, through his intellectual curiosity, he was sort of a classical liberal, is how we'll say that. And let me just say, is Nolan trying to make any political statements in this film? No, let me rephrase that. I think Nolan is far more interested in mythologizing 20th century America with Oppenheimer as a Prometheus figure. He is far more interested in myth than he is getting into political territory. The politics of this film just happen to be the backdrop. And the way the politics are incorporated into the narrative is not in a way to make a political statement, but far more in a way to generate tension and narrative conflict. It's almost like window dressing to the mythology, in a sense. But it is there, and to know the history of it is, it sort of helps frame it in a certain way. So Oppenheimer had these early affiliations with the American Communist Party. Now, why is any of that important? Because in 1954, Oppenheimer was part of a security hearing that really revolved around him that was carried out by the Atomic Energy Commission, the AEC. And they pretty much just explored his background. And it resulted in his security clearance being revoked. I mean, this is the guy who, built the atomic bomb. I mean, at the time, there was no higher security clearance that could be given. And in the aftermath of this, his security clearance was revoked. And much of it had to do with his affiliations with the Communist Party way back in the 1930s. So this was sort of McCarthy era, the Red Scare, the stuff that this guy, did 20 plus years ago, was coming back, casting doubt on his loyalties to the nation, especially regarding these high profile projects that eventually resulted in his security clearance being revoked. So I would say that Oppenheimer as a film is liberal, but I want to caution what I say here, because it is a classical kind of liberalism, and there really is a difference. There really is a difference between liberal in a classic sense and then what you see being propagated today, which is just utter nonsense. Some people will make the distinction this way. They will say that Oppenheimer is liberal, but it isn't woke. And Oppenheimer, like many liberals of that time, I think he was sort of, he would be considered today something of a moderate, but at the time, very naive, let's say, of the far left and where those ideas could eventually lead. And the film is a fascinating character study of sort of that type of person. Again, his affiliations with the American Communist Party really stemmed, at least the film presents them, from an intellectual curiosity, just seeing what's out there. At no point do you see him, as this sort of gung-ho, die-hard communist rebelling against fascism. No, you don't see that. He's just sort of there. He's at these parties because he's invited, and he's sort of flirting with the ideas and considers them just like anybody else, and is sort of open about it and willing to talk through implications and things like that. And it's through the contrivances of Louis Strauss, played by Robert Downey Jr. in the film, that sort of results in Oppenheimer being undone in the physics community and in his standing with the government much later on in his life. He has this internal dilemma that he wrestles with throughout the entire film. Again, it's whether, you know, this is, you know, the world's greatest achievement, or if it's, you know, this is the chain reaction that leads to the end of the world. But ultimately, I think the way the film sort of gets into the political territory is far more concerned with nationalism run amok than, you know, communism or fascism or anything like that. I think those are ideas in the film because they were ideas of that time. It's part of the mythologizing of the 20th century that those ideas are there. It's not that Nolan so much has an axe to grind. What I do think Nolan offers a very, very pointed take on is nationalism. And this is seen in the scene immediately following the aftermath of the dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, where Oppenheimer is sort of asked to give this, is expected to give this kind of speech about it. And all the people who are there are, well, most of them, most of the people who are there are just, they are cheering, right? They're celebrating this. But then there are others who have worked on the project who are just gutted because they realize there are many, many people we just killed. But most of these people are celebrating this, not even really kind of knowing what they're celebrating. And Oppenheimer, while he tries to give this, you know, sort of, I guess, what's supposed to be a rousing victory speech, I mean, he has that really shocking moment where, like, he's trying to walk out and he steps, it's very, very chilling. He steps like into, it's sort of a vision. It's sort of a, you know, he's seeing it in his head, but he's sort of walking and his foot gets caught and he looks down and he has stepped inside of the corpse, like the charred corpse of a human being that results from the, you know, the blast. And it really raises interesting questions about just war theory. Those ideas are thrown around in the film, not just as window dressing and not talked about in the context of just Oppenheimer. There are several scenes where there is a debate of, is this the right thing to do? And that's his great conflict, you know, building this bomb. There are several scenes in which the point is made that by doing this, we are saving lives. It is the only way that we're going to get the Japanese to surrender, by dropping these bombs. Some of that dialogue is thrown out there. That's ultimately, in the long run, going to save the lives of our soldiers. It's going to get them to surrender. It's going to prevent other people from going to war. We're ultimately saving lives by creating something like this because it just subsumes all the power. And then, you know, the flip side of that is, we're killing people. And not like in any sort of traditional warfare tactics. You're not talking about, you know, attacking a city and, you know, killing a few of its inhabitants or whatever. I mean, you're talking about wiping out, you know, innocent combatants. And it gets into very murky territory. Just to frame the conversation a little bit, the just war theory or the just war tradition is something that deals with, it's a philosophical concept that just deals with the justification of how and why wars are fought. There's a really strong just war tradition in Christianity, especially. The church father Augustine is sort of credited with doing a ton of work on just war theory. I think we actually covered just war theory in some detail back when we covered, was it Andor?
Yes, it was in the Star Wars series Andor, which is on Disney.
Yeah. So I know we've talked about just war theory before, and Oppenheimer certainly gets into this. And Nolan, I think that the communism and the fascism and those ideas are sort of window dressing because he's mythologizing the 20th century. But he does give a very pointed critique, I think, of nationalism, of, you know, celebrating something just because your country did it and just because it's the country that you were born into and have citizenship in doesn't necessarily make it right. And I think that's actually one of the film's strengths. And again, it's very timely. It's very of the moment. I think it's sort of interesting. Like you mentioned, it's sort of set in the past, and some people may wonder, well, why on earth would we care about this? When you watch the film, you get the sense that this is Nolan's most timely film, even though it's set in the 20th century. It's not set in the modern era, or today rather, but it's I guess it is a modern film, but it's set in the 20th century. It deals with timeless themes. It deals with mythic themes. It's not really a now film, but because it deals with these mythic themes and presents these characters in this way, it very much feels like a movie of the moment. And I think it's a film that will be talked about for years to come, and rightly so. So it's certainly a film that Christians should pay attention to in that sense and be up on.
You briefly mentioned earlier the film's apocalyptic vision, and apocalyptic not in terms of a biblical one, but more of a secular one. Could you flesh this out a little bit more and tell us what you mean when you write in your review that he has this secular apocalyptic vision? And how would Christians use that to interact with friends who are seeing this film? It's so popular. A lot, if people are going to see a film in the theaters, especially adults, they are watching this film.
So let's talk a little bit about the apocalyptic genre then. Now, this may be sort of odd to people, because when we say the word apocalyptic, we conjure, you know, images of the end of the world in our head. And that's very valid, fair. But apocalyptic literature, when you hear this talked about in like theological or hermeneutical circles, right? Apocalyptic literature is a genre of prophetic writings that developed primarily in among Jewish writers, among Israelites, during the post-exilic period. And what this type of, this is the whole idea of the day of the Lord in the Old Testament that's picked up on in the New Testament and is sort of brought to fruition in the book of Revelation. The, as a genre, apocalyptic literature, it details and sort of paints an author's vision of the end of an age. The word apocalypse itself, coming from the ancient Greek, means revelation. So, you know, the book of Revelation, not Revelations. There's only one revelation given to John. People say Revelations all the time. There's not multiple ones. There's one. Revelation is apocalypse. It's its title. And it just literally means this sort of unveiling or a peeling back of the curtain. Like in The Wizard of Oz, you pull the curtain back and you see what you haven't seen before. It's a revealing or an unfolding of things that were not previously known. That's the idea of what a revelation is. And these apocalyptic writings became very popular in the post-exilic period, the Day of the Lord, that thing that sort of reaches its fulfillment in Revelation. That style of writing, that apocalyptic genre, is sort of channeled here in some ways, and I think it's very fascinating. Nolan presents a version of the apocalypse that is completely secular. It's completely modern. It's completely scientific. And in some ways, we shouldn't be surprised by this. That's the thing I think is so fascinating about choosing to tell this film as mythology rather than as, you know, like a documentary, which I think is how most any other filmmaker would have gone with it. What that does is it enables one, especially a Christian apologist or someone who's looking for an angle into this discussions about this, it really enables them to latch onto this. It's an apocalyptic film in that sense. And Nolan shows the end of the world through Oppenheimer's eyes. He shows a potential end of the world that is the result of nuclear weapons. So it channels a very ancient kind of literature in some ways. I think I said earlier that the ending of the movie, if you're just seeing the clip of it, looks like it could be out of someone's interpretation of the book of Revelation. You know, you've got the world being incinerated in fire because of these nuclear bombs that Oppenheimer has created. The ending scene is actually very good. It's very well done, by the way. I will not spoil that particular aspect, the particular thing that leads into that scene, just because it's a question that runs throughout the entire film, and it really is worth seeing. It's almost worth seeing just for that ending scene alone with him and Einstein. I think it's wonderful. But those last few seconds of him envisioning a potential future in which nuclear weapons are used to incinerate the Earth, it's something straight out of what could be. If you just detach that from its context, it could be sort of something out of post-exilic Jewish literature. It's really sort of fascinating in that way. And so the film has a very apocalyptic bent. It has a very clear apocalyptic vision, but it is a humanistic one. It is a scientific one. There's very little talk of religion in this film, even though it's rife with religious symbolism. I think it's rife with mythic imagery. It's rife with mythic archetypes. There's no real examination of the religious angle of it. But I certainly think there's room for Christians to step in and see what the film is doing and see a potential future in which the world ends, which I think we can all agree is something we believe if we've read Revelation and take it even remotely literally. I think in the review, I think I say it this way. John writes Revelation, Christopher Nolan wrote Oppenheimer. Both present the end of the world, but only one of them ends in a rescue. And that's the key difference. And that's also the Christian's inroad into discussions of the apocalyptic vision of this film. It was Nolan's conviction, or I guess I should say it is Nolan's conviction. He said this in an interview with the New York Times, that Oppenheimer, J. Robert Oppenheimer, is the most important person to have ever lived. Because if fears are realized, then he is the man that destroyed the world. And his logic goes, the person who destroys the world would by definition be the most important person who ever lived. If you've read Revelation, I would agree with Chris Nolan on that. And it sort of makes you wonder what Nolan would do with a film about Jesus of Nazareth, which I think is very interesting. So I think there is a very interesting apocalyptic vision in Oppenheimer, and it's certainly something that Christians can find room to talk about in the public sphere.
And I definitely think it's a springboard to thinking about just, you know, the nature of man, and if we have the power to do this, like, what happens, you know, is this world all there is? There's so much that a Christian can use to get into conversations with people who are not religious. Well, finally, on a much lighter note than nuclear war, I guess, if people could only watch one Christopher Nolan film, you told us your favorite and what you think is his best, this particular film, but if they could only watch one, what would you recommend?
Why would you do this to me? My favorite is Insomnia. It's his only other rated R. Maybe Memento's rated R, but I know it's his, one of his other rated R films.
I believe Memento is rated R.
Yeah. So Memento is rated R. Insomnia is rated R. Insomnia is my personal favorite. I would say Oppenheimer. I do think it is Nolan's best film. I was talking with someone after seeing it. It's not so much a film as it is an impression of a film because of the way it plays with time and the 3-hour runtime. It really doesn't follow, in a sense, a traditional plot structure as we would think of it. It follows much more of like a classic tragedy structure than anything. But I do think it is his best film, and only someone like Chris Nolan could make this film the way he has made it and it be successful. I think if anyone else touched this film, it would be looked at as some kind of weird art house, sort of relegated to the sidelines film. But because it's Nolan who made it, it's a popular film. It's going to be a popular film. It is very well made, and it is very well acted, and it is very important, I think. So in that respect, I would say Oppenheimer's the Nolan film to see.
Well, thanks, Cole, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to episode 352 of the Postmodern Realities podcast. Today's guest was Cole Brigette, who has written a review for us about the film Oppenheimer in theaters now. Cole's film review is called Far From the Gods, How Oppenheimer Mythologizes 20th Century America. And you can read his article for free at our website, equip.org. Stay connected with the Christian Research Institute and all the new content we have coming your way. The best way to do that is to head on over to our website, equip.org. There you will find thousands of free resources right at your fingertips, from articles to video to audio, and it's all for free. You'll find our podcasts hosted there, as well as the Bible Answer Man broadcast, which is hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and streams live every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. In addition, you don't want to miss out on subscribing to Hank Unplugged, which is the podcast of Hank Hanegraaff. And in that podcast, he has really in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people. And in addition, he has a new series on his podcast feed called Hank Unplugged Shorts, which Hank goes into the headlines in the mainstream media and refutes a lot of those cultural issues that we have in these short podcast episodes. And there's quite a few of them. You don't want to miss out on them. Now, if you want to find some of this at other places where it's all in one place, really subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's a great way to get all of our content there, our podcasts there, and different individual questions theologically that people have that Hank answers at our YouTube channel. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, I don't know how to subscribe to YouTube. I don't have a YouTube account. Well, actually, you might just have a YouTube account. If you have a Gmail address, you have a YouTube account. Just log into YouTube with your Gmail address and search for Bible Answer Man channel, and please become one of our subscribers. In addition, if you see that bell icon right there on our front page, please click that, and every time that we have new content, you will receive a notification that new content is up on our channel for you to be able to consume. So thank you so much for the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute. We are grateful for you listening and reading and watching.